10 minutes late now. We've given everybody. Thank you. The Revenue Committee for April 10th, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go slightly out of order today and start with the information meeting on the tobacco tax distribution. And with a little luck, more of the members will get here before we get too far into this. I'm not sure what's holding them up today, but we are now late. Kyle, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office, and I'll try to talk very slowly, Mr.
And
Chair.
And so, please.
Yes. Paul just asked me to come up and do a little background on the tobacco distribution of tax receipts. So I thought I'd just run through a couple of documents that are available for reference that will show how the receipts work through the system. And really, you can, at a high level, you can think of it, there are two initial buckets. That tobacco receipts are placed into, those that are derived from the cigarette taxes and then those that are other tobacco, which includes more or less everything that's not a cigarette. So you'll find up on OLIS under the meeting materials for today's date. It's not under any specific bill, but I have a few documents up there. The first one is just the overview, the tobacco overview. This is included in part of our basic facts document that's put out at the beginning of the session. And it goes through just some background on the taxes, the tobacco taxes themselves, where they're imposed and what amount. But I do have the distribution, and I'll go through in a little bit more in depth the cigarette distribution in just a second. But it does talk about the distribution of the other tobacco products. And it's a fairly simplified distribution. So you have three for the dollars that come in related to the OTP taxes collected. After accounting for distributors are allowed to keep up to 1.5% of the tax to cover their admin costs, and then Department of Revenue can also cover their admin costs. So after those two admin cost portions, the remainder are distributed, as you can see in the chart there, where it's about 54% is going to the general fund, 41.5% to the Oregon Health Plan, and then the remaining 4.6% is going to tobacco use and reduction account. And that's for, it doesn't matter the tobacco product, whether it's moist snuff or it's something other than moist snuff, cigars or something of that effect, anything that's considered other tobacco, so that's not a cigarette, it follows that distribution schedule. So it goes into one of those three, goes to fund one of those three programs there. The cigarette tax distribution, on the other hand, is a little bit more complicated, and I have a couple documents up here. The first one is related to 2016. It covers the 2016-2017 years. There is a one penny increase scheduled for January 1st, 2018 per pack, one penny increase per pack, so I have that distribution schedule up there as well. But I'll just go ahead and go through the 2016-2017 one, which will look the same with the exception of that one penny increase that will start next year. But so the cigarette tax, it's imposed, and I put everything up here per pack. This is per pack of 20 cigarettes. There are three different statutes that actually impose taxes on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing to keep in mind in some cases when you see legislation that is increasing the tax, it may only touch one of these statutes. And that's important because these statutes do have different allocations for those dollars that come in. So it's specific to one of these three statutes then controls the distribution. So the chart I have down here, it's a little small there. It shows these are the overall collections and how they get distributed, both on the cents per pack or by percentage terms. So you can see the Oregon Health Plan is getting about 65% of, if you're looking on that $1.32 per pack of cigarettes, that's the tax that's imposed on the Oregon level. The Oregon Health Plan is getting about 65% of that $1.32 or 86 cents per pack. And working backwards, it would be the general funds getting 22 cents per pack, or about 17%, and then mental health, 14 cents, and then you have tobacco use and reduction getting 3 cents, and the cities, counties, and Department of Transportation's Elderly Transportation Fund each get 2 cents per pack. And again, I set it up where you can follow through a little bit from each of the statutes where that distribution is. And you can see one of the more recent increase. I think this was a few years back when there was an additional 13 cents per pack placed on cigarettes. That was an ORS 323030 sub 4, and that puts it 100% that distribution is going to Oregon Health Authority and their mental health program. And so, again, that's just something to keep in mind when you're seeing the different bills that may make changes or adjusting the tax rate on cigarettes. So sometimes it can look more complicated in some cases just because it may be holding the existing distribution constant and then adding a new one on there, or it may just send it through with the exact same distribution. So there may be an additional program that's getting funded. But it can look a little odd because you can see there's that split of 30ths, 29.37ths, 30ths, and so forth. And then the last document I have up on OLIS is coming from the distribution. I actually don't see it up there. Okay, there it is. It's just the distribution of the receipts, and this comes from the Office of Economic Analysis. In their quarterly forecast, there's a page in there that has the distribution to each of the funds. And this has for both the OTP and the cigarette tax distribution. So if you want to see the actual dollars that are coming in on an annual or biannual basis, you can reference that document as well.
Okay.
And that's what I have prepared as a little background. I'm happy to take any questions if there are.
Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Chair, the OHA money, I see that. I think the one distribution in the middle here that's related to mental health, I think, was the byproduct of the 2013 grand bargain, correct?
Yes.
And that goes to mental health. Do we know whether the other portion that they get via the other parts of the cigarette tax have a specific purpose within OHA, or is it just general fund OHA type usage? Do we know whether there's any health related benefits, perhaps, at least in theory, or is there anything we can quantify?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. It usually directs it to, it's fairly broad, so it is something specific to the Oregon Health Plan. So it could be funding any, I guess, any relation to the Oregon Health Plan. There's not maybe a specific program to, smoking suppression or something like that.
Thoughts?
It'd be nice to know, I guess, since it's the largest beneficiary of the cigarette tax, to know what consumers are getting for their investment.
That makes sense. Can we find out?
Can definitely, get the information in the fall, the dollars through the program.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, that would be good. Any other questions? Has anybody recently tried to simplify this distribution system? Maybe even without, changing the actual distribution? It looks pretty complicated.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think part of the problem is even in the rounding, it can change the dollar allocations, which is one of those you do sometimes when the bill changes, but even when you just round it to a tenth or something to that effect, someone's gaining some and someone is losing a little.
All right. Well, we have a number of bills, colleagues, that will affect the amounts of these taxes and maybe even the distribution, so I thought you probably better have a look at this first, and you can see there are a lot of different interests represented in this distribution. Anything else?
Can I?
Yes, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if this was brought up already, but the did we talk about the elderly transportation and how that got in there originally?
We have not. I can research that. I don't
have
that prepared.
I just wondered if you like. Or perhaps one of my colleagues might be.
I do remember that, but I want to make sure it's 100% accurate, so I'm going to refrain. Okay. But I do remember that.
I keep thinking of how valuable it is to have a Ways and Means member on this committee as well. Thank you. Appreciate the presentation today. Given our schedule this afternoon and the timing for when people can attend, we're going to close the information meeting and open the work session on House Bill 2676. We have a little bit of an unusual process today. Representative Benson, and then I'll discuss what we're doing.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2676 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benson moves to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2676 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Let me just start by saying this is an unusual procedure, but once in a while we get new information that suggests that we need to have additional discussion, maybe even additional hearing perhaps, about a bill. So I thought the most prudent thing we could do, since we're not anywhere near the end of session, was to pull this thing back so we can consider it further. And I think I've talked with most of the members about it so that we could proceed. Other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Now, do I need to do something else? I think we need now to do the reconsideration, don't we? Or did we do the whole thing all in one? Paul, do I need to do any additional motion?
We just brought it back to the committee.
We brought it back to the committee, but now we need to move to rescind the vote by which we sent it to the floor. Isn't that correct?
Okay.
Representative Nost, would you make that motion? Are you prepared to?
I'm prepared to do it, but I could use a little help on how to actually word it.
I think what you say is I move to rescind the vote by which we sent the bill to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
I'm not going to say a recant.
You can say recant, yeah.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson, thank you for all your help. Mr. Chair, I would like to rescind the motion that I made sending House Bill 2676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Nost moves that the committee rescind the vote, reconsider the vote, and rescind it by which we sent House Bill 2676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think that gets us to the place where we had it in the work session before and able to keep it in the committee so that we can do further consideration. Any further discussion?
Can I just give a...
Please, Representative
Nost,
please.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're going to have a meeting, myself, I believe legislative council, legislative revenue staff are going to be there, the advocate for the bill, folks in the Department of Revenue, and try to figure out what the concern is. I don't remember the exact date, but I know...
It's coming.
It's coming, and I think we're going to try to move the meeting here. To see if we can get a handle on the new information that's come to light or what we didn't understand when we passed this bill, and then maybe get back to you.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Mr. Chair, perhaps you could explain to everyone what you explained to me so that they know why we're doing this.
Briefly, what is my understanding is that what has happened recently is that an appeal was made of a tax decision made by the department to one of the forums at which makes the information public information and no longer confidential. The result of that was that I got a visit from the department indicating that there were some issues that we had not heard about earlier. And it raises for me, in addition to the bill, another consideration which we haven't hit at all, and that is how do we manage situations in which we're hearing a part of the facts related to a bill and other parts might be available, but not to us because of confidentiality. But because those pieces are no longer confidential, we will get the benefit of that information, and it may or may not influence the decision of the committee to send the bill on. Is that helpful? I think it's what we've talked about before. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2676, and we'll move on to the public hearing on House Bill 3296. Thank you. You've got to go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3296 would add a tax on certain types of nicotine products that don't contain tobacco. They would be nicotine products that could be ingested. However, there's no actual tobacco in it. They are awaiting an amendment for this measure. It's not in yet, but it would make it so that this measure did not apply to certain food products. It turns out that there are some vegetables in the nightshade family that naturally contain some nicotine, and without an amendment, this measure would add a tax on those. So that's being awaited.
I wonder why I liked eggplants so much.
Well, nightshade, of course, includes potatoes, eggplants, tomatoes, and probably two or three other things that we many of us like to eat. Please, go ahead. Is that it?
Yeah, that's about it.
Okay, all right. Let's see. we've got a lot of people signed up here today. Why don't we hear from the state departments first? Katrina Hedberg, is it Hedberg? Deanna Mack? Then also perhaps from the league, Wendy Johnson. So it looks to me like the three of you have some information to add that might be helpful, so why don't we start with you?
Mine will be very brief.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon City, of Oregon Cities. It's sort of a transition from the presentation that Kyle just gave on tobacco and how that tax is distributed. Cities do receive a portion of the tax revenue from cigarettes. It's very small. It's that 2 cents. We do not receive any tax revenue from the other tobacco. And you've had plenty of vaping bills already in this committee and now this ingestible piece. So my testimony is simply that we would like to see a revenue share from these other tobacco products. The cities are responsible for policing this issue now that, for example, vaping, it can't be done by minors. The Oregon Clean Indoor Act that passed recently added vaping to the list. So we have that cost as well. And so as you think about just the distribution method of any new taxes, we would ask that you consider the cities and counties in that distribution. As you noted, it's a very complicated formula for the cigarette tax. We would not suggest anything that complicated, but especially if there's a preemption. What's particularly offensive to the cities is that when the cigarette tax was initially imposed, there was a preemption, but cities received 25% of the cigarette tax, and now you know it's 2%. And in addition, 50% went to property tax assistance. So essentially 75% of the cigarette tax originally helped out the local governments, and now we get 2%. And so some of you have received the league's brochure on what our state shared revenues look like. It's now less than $1.20 a person of what we're getting in cigarette revenues. It doesn't pay for the costs, and we're preempted from imposing that tax locally. So that's all my testimony is just to consider how you should distribute any new taxes on these new products that have now really replaced cigarettes, which we think is helpful, perhaps better than some of the other products out there, but the tax situation has not changed. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And the bill, as drafted, we just have some technical changes that we would like to request. Right now, it deals with tobacco substitutes that do not include vape, products containing tobacco, or products prescribed by a health professional for smoking cessation, yet many of them are FDA approved and they're over the counter, like Nicorette gum. So we'd want to make sure that it was clear that those are also included in this definition, so the tax would not be imposed on that, as well as some other minor technical changes relating to the terms tobacco and tobacco substitute. And we're happy to work with LRO to make sure that if the bill continues to move, that it has the correct language in it for us to administer.
Okay, thank you. And do you have an amendment, or?
I do have language we can provide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Because we're obviously going to need your help to get that part done.
Happy to do it.
Thanks.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the state health officer with the Public Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here to testify or provide information about the importance of making sure that tobacco substitute products are treated the same as other nicotine-containing tobacco products. So, again, I appreciate what you said about small amounts of nicotine in fruits and vegetables. We want people to eat fruits or vegetables. We're talking about products that specifically people are using because of the nicotine concentration in those products. So part of the issues around nicotine in and of itself and high levels can cause some toxicity. It can cause rapid heart rate. Kids, for example, who have nicotine toxicity, it's a stimulant, so anxiety, hypertension, nausea, vomiting. In fact, there have been cases of actually nicotine poisoning deaths when children contained. So nicotine in and of itself in high concentrations is dangerous. We're, of course, concerned about the other component of nicotine, which is that it is highly addictive. And we know from use for e-cigarettes, for example, that are nicotine-containing, that there are many people who use this, who use tobacco products crossover. They use sort of both e-cigarettes as well as other tobacco products. Tobacco remains the leading preventable cause of both morbidity and mortality, so illness and death, in the state of Oregon. We've also seen when new products come online, for example, e-cigarettes, we saw a sudden bump up in the increase of e-cigarettes among youth. So these types of products particularly appeal to youth and young adults, and then many of them become addicted to nicotine and then have a lifetime habit related to tobacco addiction. We also know that taxing tobacco products, and including tobacco substitute, is an evidence-based practice for decreasing use overall. And this is something that the Centers for Disease Control, when we're looking at how we limit the negative consequences of tobacco use, increasing the price of products is one way that we do that. So I'd be happy to answer any additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question could be for you or for our doctor here, but help me understand what we're talking about here again. What exactly are we referring to? It's not tobacco. It's not vaping. It's not snuff or that sort of thing. What is this tobacco substitute?
Yeah.
Page 3, lines,
defined in statute?
Lines 4 through 9, or 10. Is the definition of tobacco substitute.
But again, that doesn't give me a product name.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So Chair Barnhart and Representative Johnson, I myself had some questions. So what we find, obviously, cigarettes, cigars, pipes, we're all aware of what tobacco is. Then, of course, there's also the snuff and the tobacco, which is fine. Then there are things like orbs, which include nicotine, but they're more like a little candy. They look like Tic Tac. But again, the nicotine in those is derived from tobacco. But I think what we're talking about here is nicotine that's not derived from tobacco, so it doesn't fall under that taxation, but is a synthetic tobacco or derived perhaps from some of the other vegetables that you mentioned, members of the deadly nightshade family. In Oregon or in the United States now, we understand that there's something called ZYN-NT, which is sold by a Swedish tobacco company, which is similar to some of these other products, and Oregon is a test market for this. So I think it's not in wide distribution, but we are aware of these products, and they have the potential of coming online. Again, when you look at other products that are regulated, other tobacco-derived nicotine products, and this is a way to say, oh, they don't fall under that. But for all intents and purposes, they are the same as some of these other ingestible, if you will, forms of tobacco.
Please.
If I wanted to purchase some of these products, where would I go? Who sells this stuff?
So, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, I personally don't know. Right before I came up here, I texted it. Again, Oregon's a test market. I think you can actually get some of them online, which is in and of itself a problem. But there are potentially sites of distribution once they see whether this test market, whether it flies in Oregon. What we found when e-cigarettes started, so this was an example, after they got on the market and were here for a while, we started to see them popping up in malls, for example, and being sold. We do not see that yet. So I think in some ways, this is a little bit preemptive, that it hasn't happened wide scale yet, but that we have concerns that it may be going in that direction.
Right. Thank you. I think you answered this question, but I'm not sure. Is nicotine something that can be artificially manufactured, or does it have to be derived from some kind of a plant process? Or do we know?
So, Chair Barnhart, I don't know, but I can get you that information because, of course, you know, nicotine is a chemical, and so
yes.
Many substances both are naturally derived from plants. That's where they start, and then there is a synthetic, they're manufactured in, you know, chemical laboratories, et cetera. I don't know the answer for nicotine, but I can find that out for you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And what I understand this bill does is that it simply says that they have to pay the tax that you would pay if it were a tobacco product, even though it contains nicotine but is not a tobacco product.
Correct.
That's my understanding of what this bill would do. And, of course, it falls afoul of the nightshade issue simply because the other nightshade, something I didn't know until 10 minutes ago, apparently contains some nicotine. That may explain why I like tomatoes so much. Who knows?
So, Chair Barnard, I also think that it's probably a matter of degree. My guess is that the tomato that you enjoy or the eggplant doesn't have a very large amount of nicotine in it. And, of course, these products that we're talking about have much larger, because the purpose is that, again, they're a stimulant. We know that nicotine is a stimulant and also highly addictive. And it's that's what people are looking for, which, again, I'm not sure people are eating tomatoes for the stimulation effects.
Thank you. The Wiley tomato growers. I had no idea. Anything else for this panel? Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your testimony. Katie Thiessen?
There was a Simpsons cartoon about combining tobacco.
And I don't know if you had someone else for your panel or not. No?
Okay. About tomatoes and tobacco. Tobacco. There was a Simpsons episode about this. So maybe that's where they got it.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Katie Tyson with the Oregon Nurses Association. I will keep my comments really brief here. Just wanted to testify in support of the bill today because although we know that combustible tobacco products are the most dangerous, there's certainly a lot of evidence that ONA nurses are aware of that nicotine is equally bad and can cause a number of diseases from heart disease to lung disease. So we just want to support taxing all nicotine products at their broadest capacity tobacco substitute products be regulated the same, and that we know increasing the price of these products is the best way to curb youth access in particular. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, but just wanted to testify in support of the bill.
What do we know about the if anything at this stage, about the nature of first use and continued utilization of these products? We've heard in other bills, for example, we've heard testimony how vaping may, in fact, for younger people, lead to the use of regular tobacco products. That nicotine is highly addicting. I think by this point, everyone should know that. What do we know about the kind of product that we're trying to deal with here, mm-hmm. in those areas, epidemiologically, I guess? And probably I should have asked the epidemiologist this question.
Yeah, I don't have a specific answer to you, but, you know, as nurses, our members really believe that opening the door to any nicotine or tobacco product is a bad idea because of that sort of further down the line effect. So I'd be happy to try and find that answer for you and get back to you because I think it is a really interesting idea, Chair Barnard.
Thank you. Dr. Hedberg, did you have additional information on that point? Because if you do, I think the committee would like to hear it.
Yes, so Chair Barnard and members of the committee, we do know that the majority of people who are tobacco users or lifetime users started before the age of 18, and at least before the age of 21. In other words, nobody wakes up my age in their late 50s and says, I think I'll try a cigarette. It just doesn't happen. People also don't start by not smoking today and then tomorrow becoming a pack-a-day smoker. So we do know that the pattern of use is initially trying and that eventually there are some people who will try a few and stop, but the majority of folks will try, and then especially if it's part of the broader social or cultural group that they're in, become addicted, and pretty soon they are not able to quit.
All right. And I think your assumption might very well be that products like ZYN-NT will follow a similar pattern.
So, yes, Chair Barnard. So it's not clear to me which product. Again, we know that if you start with e-cigarettes, the kids, I call them, but youth who start often go over to other tobacco products that they don't necessarily stay the same. So my guess is that, and we also know that products such as hookah, which are tobacco but are flavored tobacco, that appeals to the youth because it's sort of easier to inhale. And the same with e-cigarettes. They often have candy flavors, et cetera, that appeal to youth, and then they become addicted. So I would say it is a fair assumption, although, again, we don't have obviously data yet, since Oregon is just a test market about whether Zyn NT would end up this same way. But my guess is that when you're using an oral product that's relatively easy to consume, if you will, it's not quite as harsh as a Camel unfiltered cigarette is to start, but it still contains nicotine, that it's an addictive substance, and that then that person may or has the potential for the lifetime of addiction.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily for the panel. I just want to make sure I'm understanding this correctly. So what we're talking about is a 65% of the wholesale sales price on all tobacco substitutes. That's, how did we choose 65%? Is it just as out of convenience because that's the same rate for other tobacco products, or was there another rationale? And there's nothing wrong if it's out of convenience because it's the same as others. I'm assuming that's the reason.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, it is the same. Couldn't speak to the reasons necessarily behind that except for some uniformity.
Okay. That's all I was trying to get at. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And, we probably would need additional testimony on this topic, but it occurs to me that you don't want to give advantage in the marketplace to one kind of ingestion system or type than a different one. And setting the tax in a similar level would help with that process.
No, that seems logical to me, Mr. Chair. No. I was just trying to make sure that was the reason.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Joseph Gilpatrick and Charles Wyatt, please.
Does or does not apply to Nicorette.
Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on this bill? Gentlemen.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I was a 22-year smoker. I started smoking cigarettes at the age of about 15 years old, and my mother was a two-pack-a-day smoker at the time when I'd begun smoking. Prices of cigarettes increased through several decades. My mother's still addicted, two-pack-a-day smoker. I just wanted to share, moments of when my mom decided if I should get my lunch money or a pack of cigarettes. And, an addicted person, as many people will testify, tobacco is just as addictive as sometimes heroin or cocaine. I urge you to, maybe go down to the jail and talk to a heroin or cocaine dealer and ask them if they raise the price of their drugs, how many people stop purchasing their products. It doesn't seem to work that way. So the more we raise these products on people that are already financially burdened, these people that are addicted to tobacco are in the lower class range, $20,000 a year or less. And so, we raise the price on these products that we know that they're going to purchase and pay for because they're addicted with the justification of saying that they're not going to purchase them anymore. Well, this is a 50-year smoker, a 45-year smoker. Now these products in this bill particularly, as that Zyn NQ, that is a chewing gum that is designed exactly like Nicoderm CQ. It's the just a non-FDA approved exact replica of that from a different company. As we know, nicotine is not cancerous. It is a stimulant like caffeine, and it has a lot of health issues as far as people with heart problems. But it is a much, much healthier, much safer alternative than smoking. And for us to put it on an equal plane for a chewing gum, a nicotine supplement, and a cigar or some chew, it just doesn't really make sense to me. And for us to make a tax on something just because we know these people are going to pay for it shouldn't make it right. And I believe you guys know that too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hello, Representative Barnhart and members of the committee. My name's Charles Wyatt, and I just kind of want to start off by saying I think taxation against these products that have already been shown to be healthier, not the best, but to be healthier alternative to smoking cigarettes, I think there should be no taxation. If somebody chooses to make a healthier option to work towards a healthier future, then they shouldn't be financially burdened. Like Joe said, most of cigarette consumers are of the lower class, don't make as much money, and I want to make somebody that's making those healthier choices, give them less of a financial burden. Like when we look at New York, who taxes their cigarettes at a staggering rate of $4.35 a pack, We notice when we look at the numbers that 58% of users get their cigarettes from black markets, from out of state, or just end up buying cheaper cigarettes to begin with. And 58%, that's almost 6 out of 10 people that buy cigarettes in New York State because of the taxation goes to other revenues. And if you think that the person sneaking cigarettes across state lines is going to ID that person buying cigarettes, then you know, that's got to be a pretty honest person. Pennsylvania, and I understand vaping is not, this hasn't anything to do with vaping, but seeing as other, you know, there are other options of quitting smoking that are healthier than smoking. You know, Pennsylvania passed a 40% tax on vapor products in 6 months, shut down 33% of establishments, you know, selling those products. And that's a lot of people losing their jobs. Alex Clark from CASA said, "It sounds like a bad joke, but it's all too real. Pennsylvania vapers could go to prison for buying vapor products online and not paying a 40% tax on them. The penalties for evading the tax includes up to a $5,000 fine or prison time not to exceed 5 years. And the reality of that situation is that these taxes are allowing the government to go to somebody's house with a SWAT team and hold a gun to their head and force them into prison for tobacco or alternative products. You know, if these taxes were to pass on the way that I choose to consume nicotine, I would be considered a criminal because I couldn't afford those types of taxes. And if it's between paying those taxes or putting a roof over my pregnant wife's head, it's going to be putting a roof over my pregnant wife's head. And I am addicted to nicotine. Thank God I found a healthier alternative. But all that being aside, I don't see any philosophical consistency with this and things like sugar. When I was 1 year old and drinking massive amounts of Kool-Aid and such, sugar's a stimulant. Sugar's just as addictive as heroin and cocaine. And you know, they're the obesity crisis. Here's tobacco and here's obesity. But I don't see anybody, you know, I don't see anybody saying anything about sugar and the negative implications that sugar has on children. And there's just no consistency. And for that reason, I just want to see people get healthy, and I want to see people burden as little as they possibly can if they're making those steps forward to become healthy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
Thanks again.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3296 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2363. And we'll see if any of the people who wanted to testify last time and didn't get to are back. Colleagues, recall we were hearing this Thursday afternoon. And I my recollection is that there were three people who wanted to testify. We're down to one. Or maybe the department's ready. Oh, okay, please. Are there those who are standing, please come up, plus Wendy Johnson, please. No, that's fine.
Chair Barnhart, I didn't really want to testify, but you gave me a little homework last week. So
I did.
Yeah, here
I
to
did
report,
give you some homework. Why don't you state your name and then respond to the homework question.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division. So last week, if you recall, you had a question at the end of the hearing for the department, and you just basically asked if there were any safeguards, and you can certainly restate your question if you'd like, but you basically asked if there were any safeguards in the bill that would protect the money that the county was already spending on A&T. And so you said that your concern, as I understand it, was that because the county would have this new source of money and the 2% fee that they could charge the districts, that they would just turn around and reduce their own contribution. And so I think the short answer is that the bill as drafted or with the Dash 1 amendment does not have a lot of that assurance in it. But I want to let you know that I worked with Representative Brock Smith and with Representative Marsh also was there, and we did a little bit of working on this to try and fine-tune what an amendment that would take care of that might look like. And so a couple of ideas that are out there, and again, the amendments are not drafted at this time, and ultimately it'll be up to the sponsors of the bill as to what it looks like. The department's neutral on whatever the policy would be, but I think that we might be looking at something that might have a provision that basically says that while a county may have to reduce their budget because they simply don't have the money, that they would not be able to reduce their budget for A&T, for assessment and taxation, to any more degree than the overall budget reduction that the county goes through in any given year. So that would be one thing that could tend to address your issue. Secondly, I think that we're going to move to say that you're only able to charge this 2% fee if you're a participant in the CAFA program, and that will make sure, and right now all counties are members of the CAFA program, we're all participating in the CAFA program, and as a part of that grant review process, it gives us a pretty good peek under the hood as far as what type of resources they're dedicating to assessment and taxation. So that would be the second thing. And then the third thing that the amendment will seek to address is that it'll require some type of enhancement or augmentation or increase in the county A&T function if a county takes this option to charge the 2% fee. And so the thought here is that it could be perhaps by rule, the Department of Revenue might set some standards, but overall it's going to be a matter of resource, so dollars and staffing is what the issue is really going to be for the department, to say that you're enhancing the effort that you're putting into A&T. And so I think that the long and the short of it should be that after you look at CAFA, the county's contribution, plus the 2%, that should be greater than what was being spent prior to the 2% on just CAFA and the county portion. So those are some thoughts that we've come up with, and certainly there's a little bit more work that can be done. But in the bill as written, currently all we have is the CAFA grant process. And, you know, and the department does, like I said, give a hard look at these counties. And we have been approving all of the counties as being minimally adequate at this time. But we have put some of the counties on notice that we feel like their funding levels currently may not be sustainable in the long run to have a healthy assessment and taxation system. We feel like there could be some counties where roll values are suffering a little bit, and we've told them that we may require them to increase their contributions at the county level in the future if they are to continue to be participants in the CAFA program.
Thank you. People are all talking about different topics, so if we have questions for Mark, let's ask them now. The one I have, a couple of ones I've got, I guess. One of them is, we heard testimony on Thursday, I think it was Curry County, if I remember correctly, about the claim that sufficient additional property tax dollars could be obtained by properly assessing properties, mm-hmm, to pay for this amount and actually return a little bit more to the districts that were... that we're contributing toward it. It seems to me that if we were to proceed with a bill like this, we'd want to have assurances in the law that would make it clear that the effort that was in being involved would actually allow the assessor to fulfill that claim, or at least to do all the work from which it could be fulfilled if he's right about the number and size and percentage of properties that are not properly assessed now. I think that's a little different than what you said, but I'm not sure. So.
Chair Barnhart, I think that, you know, the amendment language that we're looking at, I think, does point to that issue, and it just says that basically things are going to have to get better at the county level than where it's at right now in order for you to be able to utilize this 2% fee option. There was also testimony on Thursday about the District 1 project that they had where they put more money into personal property collections. You can understand how for a county, knowing that they're only going to get a sliver of that money, I don't know if they can consider it to be a wise use of the resources for the county budget. Mm-hmm. For everyone, it did bring in more money, that District 1 project. But had the state not been paying for it, it would have been a loser for the county budget. And that was, I think, the point that they tried to make.
Thank you.
As far as whether this will actually bring in more money or not, that is a good question and hard to quantify, I think. But
The other question I had to do with, I think, Section 1 of the bill. I don't have it in front of me, but that's my recollection. That has to do with, and if I'm thinking of the correct bill, has to do with the qualifications for what counties are allowed to participate. It would seems to me that a different method of determining that might be prudent.
Chair Barnhart, I think that that'll also be part of the amendments. I think that the latest direction is maybe that you would say that counties with less than a $2 permanent rate would be eligible to use this. That would put 12 counties in.
Yeah, that would include Lane County, where I live.
Well, there you go. And so it would put more counties in, and it would avoid what could be a yo-yo effect over time, where a county might qualify to use this fee in 1 year, and then in subsequent years they get taken off the Secretary of State's list, and then that 2% option is no longer available to them, and so they're back into instability with their budgets.
Into the soup. All right. Thank you. Ladies, please.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. As you might guess, the League opposes this measure as well as the Dash One Amendment. It's literally taking from one taxpayer and making another taxpayer pay for these fees to get assessment and taxation done. I think a rising boat and the water, you know, rising tide raises all boats. That's true here, but this is shifting it all to the other taxing districts. We just don't think it's the right solution. The League has been working on property tax reform for quite a number of years, and we recognize that if we go back to a real market value system, we're definitely going to need more money for assessment and taxation. But we're not there yet this session on making that happen. And we also agree that we need to fix the A&T funding with the system we do have. This just isn't the right solution for a number of reasons. The first that should be obvious is 41% of property taxes come from schools. And so this bill is going to be taking from the school budget, which means you're going to have to backfill it with general fund dollars anyway. So I don't have the math now that you've gotten it if you do the Dash One Amendment with only the four counties. But if you do it with the bill as it's written, it would be a loss of $104 million from the school budget. So this is real money here that we're talking about. So 41% of property taxes go to schools, 21% go to cities, 17% from counties, and 14% from special districts, and then a little 4% for community colleges and 4% for urban renewals. So we all have a different share. But the big point of it, though, is that the county function, a couple of main county functions are assessment and taxation, health and human services issues that the county provides, and public safety. And the fact of the matter is this group of counties isn't meeting those basic functions, and it's that's what their responsibility is to do assessment and taxation. My cities are all responding with that's their function. So why is it they can't pay? Well, we've heard about the timber changes and just the economies in these districts, and we're sympathetic to that. But if you look at these four counties that are on the grade list, their permanent rate, Josephine County is 59 cents. Curry County is 60 cents, and these counties have refused to do a local option levy. So that's the hard reality. And that sounds foreign if you on those numbers as well, 59 cents and 60 cents. So let me tell you what that looks like. If you have a $200,000 home, and a $200,000 valued home isn't really going to be taxed on $200,000, mind you, because it'll be an assessed value with a discount of at least 10%, if not 20, 30, or 40%. Let's just say it's a $200,000 home. At a 60 cents, that's 0.06%. So that's an incredibly low tax rate. Your year county bill is $120. So that's what these folks are paying on a $200,000 house, $120. And now they want the cities and the school districts to pay more because the local option levy won't pass to pay their share. So that's the problem here. Is their permanent rate is that low. It's not totally the only problem here. We do have Measure 5 caps that some areas have hit. We do have the 3% growth limit, so even if properties are going up, the assessments are not going up enough. So, but still, 59 cents, 60 cents. Douglas County is $1.11, and they're only gonna go up 3% a year. So it's our property tax system that's part of the problem. It's the other parts of Measure 5 and 50 that are also part of the problem. In Curry County, there are only three cities, incorporated cities. There's lots of little towns, but they're not incorporated. So they're not paying any other tax besides the county tax and the special districts and school districts. The three cities are Brookings, Port Orford, and Gold Beach. I asked the good assessor, did you talk to those three cities? no. What do you think they would say if you were going to now shift it to them? They would oppose. And why is that? Well, their permanent rates, Brookings is $376, Gold Beach is $234, Port Orford is $227, and Curry County is paying 60 cents. So if we're going to shift it, this is the problem. You're going to make the school districts lose money. You're going to make the cities lose money. I think that the fact of the matter is this needed to be done in a work group like we did last time when we were in a crisis and we agreed to give up our interest on the delinquencies, and we helped work together on that. Again, now this one is taking from schools as well, and so you're going to have that hole to fill. But the cities have stepped up. They've passed their local option levies. They're paying for their police and fire. You'll hear from special districts. And so this just isn't the right solution to take from one taxing entity to another. It's complicated, and I appreciate some of the comments made from Department of Revenue on how some ways to make it a little better. But the other big part of the problem in this bill is that there's no sideboards. It doesn't say, well, how do we come up with what's the right budget for this assessment and taxation? It seems to me that the neutral party is the Department of Revenue, but you heard on Thursday that these four counties have still met the minimum, what was the words, minimally adequate system. So if we don't think it's good enough, we have to say, well, why isn't it good enough? And then what's the gap? We need to know that, because we can't just say, okay, these counties are in distress. But so what is it that, how much more money do they need so that they can do what is what we think is the right amount? We don't have that in this bill. So we need a trigger, and we need a neutral convener to figure out what the budget is. And I think it's already been explained that the way the bill is written, there's no assurance that the county will continue to pay at least what they're at now. When you look at those columns that LRO put together, the counties are actually going to pay less the way it's written with the 2%. They would be responsible for less. Instead, it would be shifted. And so that's alarming. So in other words, we want this to be, if we're going to pay this, we need to be in addition to what they've got now, not a supplement, or I mean to replace, rather, a substitute. We have a couple of other ideas that perhaps aren't popular, but at least it would be fair. The state statute provides that if you pay on time on November 15th, you get a 3% discount. Well, if these counties are in distress, a fair way to make sure everybody pays the same would be to remove that discount to pay for it. That would have paid for the folks in the unincorporated as well as the incorporated. Not real popular amongst my cities that are in the incorporated, but at least it's fair and the unincorporated folks are paying their fair share. That would be not so popular with the commissioners as well, but that's frankly where part of the problem is we're not getting a tax increase. You could do it at the 2% or 3%. You can fiddle with that. Obviously, there's the CAFA fund as well, and that's the history has been explained of how there used to be a general fund paying more towards that CAFA fund. That would be a way for the state to pay for the school portion of it to increase that area. It's Senate Bill 5535 is the Department of Revenue's bill, budget bill. And in that presentation, they explained all of the CAFA program. And it's now at 20%. That's how much CAFA is paying for counties. And I think as Gail Riddell from the Association of Oregon Counties explained, the goal originally was for CAFA to pay 35-ish%. So perhaps that's something that the Joint Ways and Means Committee can handle. I think I said revenue. The Joint Ways and Means Committee that can handle that is chaired by Representative Smith. Is to fix that CAFA gap to fill where we haven't been able to meet the need there. We also just are not agreeing with some of the comments about, well, if the cities chip in, they're going to get it back. I've talked to several of our cities, and they don't think that will happen because a lot of these omitted properties are in the unincorporated parts. Roseburg is the largest city in that county, and they don't believe at all that they would make up that their 2% would be. So we're concerned about that. I could go on, but basically it's a complicated issue that's really exacerbated by our Measure 5 and 50 system, and this solution of moving it from one taxpayer to another just we don't think is the right solution. We agree wholeheartedly with the sponsors that we need a fix, because we can't have this broken system continue and not because once you mess up what the assessment is, then we're stuck at that forever, because that's where your MAV is. That's not good. But that's hurting the general fund for schools. It's hurting all the taxing districts, but we can't do it the way it is as it's written. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Special districts.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our membership represents 930 special taxing districts throughout the state of Oregon. There are 31 different types of special districts, what we refer to as the Big Six: water, fire, sewer, parks, ports, and irrigation, and then a whole host of other types of taxing districts. And as you heard at the last hearing, a new type of taxing district, a predator control district, a very interesting type of district that we're now representing. Some of our districts are very, very dependent on property tax revenue. We don't receive state shared revenue. We don't receive liquor. We don't receive cigarette. So for some districts, 95% of their entire budget is made of property tax revenue, and those districts are typically rural fire protection districts, libraries, and a large portion of most parks and recreation districts' budgets come from property taxes. So tax exemptions and redirecting existing property tax revenue to other sources are of great concern to us and our membership. We're not gigantic like the cities, some cities and some smaller cities. We're really, some of us are very small. 36% of our districts have five or fewer FTEs, and 45% of our membership's budgets are $100,000 or less. So revenue impacts to them are real, especially as it relates to rural fire protection districts. As you've already heard, we already contribute 25% of delinquent, of interest off of the delinquent property tax. We feel like we gave at the well once with the cities, and we are participating in what we believe is a county function. It should be funded by counties, in addition to the other services that Wendy mentioned. You know, elections is a county service function, and we help fund those already, and we do not want to expand that into the assessment and taxation realm. I submitted written testimony, and I attached a chart of all of the affected taxing districts under this measure in the four counties. Taxing districts listed in yellow are our members, and then the rest are cities or just districts that don't belong to Special Districts Association. As you can see from that sideways list, sorry about that, from the sideways list, there are a lot of rural fire protection districts. And I just want to point out one thing that's different about special districts compared to cities and counties. We are single service providers. So unlike a city if there is a budget reduction that needs to take place, they get to choose, okay, we take it out of the library or we do something with the parks. We just provide one single service. So anything that reduces our revenue affects that one single service that we provide. I wanted to make a couple of points based upon Mark's comments about potential. First of all, I just did want to say that predator control district in Klamath Falls, it actually did join our association. And it was on the ballot in May of 16 for 8 cents per $1,000, and they collect a whopping $8 per year. So it's not surprising to me that they would say, sure, go ahead and take 2% of our revenue. And Williams Fire District that you heard testified to, they impose $175,000 total per year in property taxes. Their budget's $280,000 a year. They have two FTEs and one volunteer. I'm not surprised that Williams Fire District said, sure, go ahead and take 2% of our taxes. We kind of have the reverse situation of being really small, so 2% really doesn't necessarily affect the super tiny people, but we do have some districts that are levying significant amounts of money, like in Douglas County Fire District number 2, which has had some financial problems in the last couple of years anyway. So as it relates to the 3% discount, I'd be shot on the spot by my membership if I agreed to take the 3% discount. So that's a non-starter for us. We do agree that there should have been a work group on this. You know, I guess a couple of our districts were reached out to. We know that these taxes have to be collected in order for our districts to remain afloat, but this just doesn't, we were not participating in any of the workup of this bill, and it does not seem that there are any sideboards to this. I'm concerned, extremely concerned, about changing the number of counties that would qualify for this to 12 counties. Anybody with a permanent rate of $2 or less, that would triple. quadruple the number of district or counties that would be eligible for this, and we wouldn't support that either. So Wendy's laid out a couple of things. I do support Mark Garst's attempt, if there is a forthcoming amendment, to require that there be an enhancement in assessment and taxation generated revenue in order for you to get the 2%, if that's what you end up doing. There should be some sort of provision that says you are going to do more and you're going to get more if we give you this 2% rather than just maintain the status quo. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? I think we're going to await the view of the amendments. Oh, Representative Marsh, did you have something?
I do have a question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Do you think there's a potential for some local conversations around this? When we talk about work group, it's always up at this level. But I think the good intention of this bill is to recognize that we have at the local level common constituencies, overlapping goals, and the opportunity to really look at the struggle that's everybody has a piece of and figure out a way to do it more efficiently and maybe to make that pot grow in the process. So I'm just wondering if those kind of conversations, instead of starting at this level and going down, could start at the local level and bubble up in terms of what we hear from local communities.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, it's actually one of my points that I just didn't make, is that each one of these four counties that's on the list has a very different fiscal story, mm-hmm. and just the geography and their finances and their economies are very different. And so it is awkward to do state policy because the reasons that they're in the situation they're at and how they could work together is just different. And a local solution would probably be a better solution than trying to come up with a scheme of a formula here. And so those conversations just haven't happened. In the interim, and in fact, you know, we were led to believe this bill was not going forward, and that we would continue to work on this issue of assessment taxation in the next year. So it was a surprise that this came out this way, because we recognize it's a problem, but we also recognize we really need property tax reform, which would fix a lot of this mess. So that's sort of the chicken and the egg, but we would prefer a local fix and some leadership there.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, and I just like to say that I think that in some ways this actually was a bit of a local initiative. As Wendy said, you know, this wasn't brought by the Assessors Association overall. This certainly wasn't a Department of Revenue initiative. So I think that this is what some assessors down in Southern Oregon, District 1, they had worked together on this project, and they were grappling with how they were going to fund their assessment and taxation going forward. And this was the idea that they came up with. So this was their local solution, but, you know, I certainly think that ongoing conversations could happen, so.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I think, we have one more. Please, come forward.
Surprised you forgot about me.
Oh, no, I hadn't forgotten, but I thought maybe you had.
No, it's craft the bill to just do.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor, testifying for the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, and we are neutral on this bill. You heard testimony last week from assessors that were in favor of this bill, and we don't stand against their position. But as an association, we determined that we would stay neutral. We do believe that there's a need for stable funding for assessment and taxation purposes. Is this bill the solution? I don't know. It could be a part of it. There's probably some other options out there too. Some of them have been brought up. So I think that what was discussed was, you know, having a work group or some local discussion is probably going to be a good thing to see if we can resolve some of this. There has been some, not by the people here, but some written testimony that was submitted said it was partly because of some bad management and stuff that they can't do their job, and that's not the case. It's a function of the tax law we work under. Because of the property taxes, the permanent rate, the counties that are in trouble right now are the ones that had significant reliance on ONC. And when that went away, they couldn't change their rate. And I'm not sure that that is the fact with the cities. I'm not sure the cities received any ONC money. And so their permanent rate is their permanent rate. It's what they were levying, growing at 3% plus whatever value increase there is. So a couple things I would like to mention is that it seems like almost every legislative session we see more and more work asked of assessor's offices with no or minimal additional funding provided. This session alone, there are bills that would expand the assessor's lien collection responsibility for cities trying to collect on energy efficiency loans. Districts want to, and by the way, Representative Marsh and I have talked about that one, and there is a funding mechanism in that. So I want to just admit that. Districts want to exempt more single-unit housing for low-income families. There are seismic upgrade bills being supported by cities that will require assessors to track upgraded costs against tax exemptions. Cities are asking to have their city boundary be the area for the change property ratio. Districts are asking to collect taxes on exempt property and to be allowed to reduce their assessed value on property. None of these bills, except for the one that I mentioned, have any revenue offset or funding mechanism for assessment and taxation. Senior citizen advocates want to freeze the taxes on seniors' homes. Veterans advocates want to exempt more value from veterans' houses. Cannabis, beer, and liquor equipment could be exempt as food processing. We will have to send out additional forms for business personal property reporting. Assessors levy and collect taxes for the Oregon Department of Forestry, but a few years ago when assessors asked them to pay an administration fee through a bill we requested, we were shut down. When counties asked the legislature several years ago for an increase in the recording fee for CAFA, we were shuffled down because affordable housing advocates because they wanted a recording fee to fund affordable housing. Now affordable housing advocates are asking for a recording fee to increase from $20 per recording to $40 per recording. Taxing districts feel, maybe rightly so, that if a county can't get a local option passed to provide more services to taxpayers, why should the districts pay 2% of their revenue to fund assessment and taxation? I ask instead that assessors work with our own counties, cities, and districts to find a resolution to this problem. Improperly staffed assessors' offices could have an impact on all districts, not just the county. And I think you saw some of that in what the assessor in Curry County testified on about the additional revenue that was generated because he had done some inspections. The question was asked, or maybe it wasn't asked, but implied that there would be additional revenue captured if this funding was provided. As a Polk County assessor, I can't guarantee that. I am one of the ONC counties. I am one of the distressed counties. But I believe that my office is run very efficiently, and I am not sure that we would find a significant amount of property that was not on the tax roll to offset the increase. So there is that issue of guaranteeing that the additional funding would provide additional revenue. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them for you.
Thank you. Questions? Well, you've learned how to testify here. No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2363. Colleagues, I just wanted to let you know that we are moving to another day, not yet decided. The work sessions that were scheduled for tomorrow for House Bill 2203, 2204, and 2270. I would also note that some of you have yet to return your comments on the property tax exemption sunsets on House Bill 2859. It would be useful to have those. We plan to have another conversation about those, about that bill tomorrow. And those who would prefer to be on a work group working on this issue might simply not respond to my request for emails, and that would improve the odds of your being on the work group. Anything else for the committee today? I'm sorry, I can't help it sometimes. With that, the committee is adjourned. See you tomorrow.